I'm Molly Plunkett. I'm a member of the congregation, and I am involved with a couple of the committees for Prairie, Social Action with Pam Gates, and Communications with Katrina Thompson. I want to welcome you all today to Prairie Universalist Society. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Today we're presenting a program by the two founders and chief operators of the Catalyst Project, which is the charity that we have been benefiting for the past 3 months by sharing our offertory plate, and they're here today. Mother and daughter. Okay. We have opening words today by Sagesis Livingston of Infamous Mothers, and I'm guessing Rachel's reading those. Thank goodness, I wasn't sure. I believe that one of the best measures of a society is how it treats those women and girls most marginalized. Teen moms, women on drugs, sex workers, women and girls experiencing homelessness, impoverished women, single mothers, women in low-income housing, women on welfare, women of color, women with mental and physical health challenges, women experiencing domestic abuse, victims of rape. I believe that a healthy society is one in which those at the center scream in agony when those furthest away are cut. It hurts when they hurt. It cries when they cry. And it moves and acts on their behalves. Equally and more importantly, it is invested in making sure they have the tools and resources to act on their own behalves. And I believe this because I understand that most things, if not all things in life, are only as strong as its most vulnerable parts. We will now light our chalice.
We light this chalice for all who are here and all who are not, for all who have ever walked through our doors, for those who may yet find their spiritual home, and for those we can't even yet imagine. For each of us and for all of us, may this flame burn warm and bright. Eric Walker Wilkstrom.
Thanks, Kathy and Randy. It's now my pleasure to be able to present our speakers for today, who are Anna and Susan Donahue, mother and daughter, who have established and work with the Catalyst Project that we've been benefiting, and Pam Gates will tell you more about them, and then they will take over.
I first learned about the Catalyst Project from the Isthmus in August 2016 article that indicated Catalyst Project was forming and opening a home for homeless mothers and their children, young children, on the east side of Madison. And The thing that attracted me most about the Catalyst Project was that the founders wanted a collaborative approach, that they are going to collaborate with the people who are living in the house to do what is best for everybody so that they can make changes in their lives. Both Susan and Anna Donahoe, is it Hugh or Ho? Which, Who? Donahue, okay. Okay. I keep getting corrected every time I write it on the computer. Okay, so Susan and Anna Donahue both have backgrounds in both social work and early childhood education. And I'm not going to talk a lot more about them because they will be telling you about the Catalyst Project, and that's what we want to hear about. So thank you. Thank you for coming today.
Are they going to need microphones?
Oh, yes. Al? Okay.
Should we stand?
Should they stand up at the podium?
Turn the center switch off.
The center.
The light switch. Turn the black one off.
The light switch. Oh. Okay. All right. And what about mics? Just give them each a mic. Good. All right.
Are they going to use the podium?
Yeah. Do you want to? Yeah. Come on up.
Then they don't need a microphone.
Oh, you can either okay. Either way.
Well, you could. Okay.
If you want to move,
I'll give you one. If you back. Think you want to move around, we'll though, you one. Can keep the mic.
Okay. Yeah.
In case you want to stand.
Catalyst Project is a two-generation approach, keyword there, to therapeutic community. That's a key phrase. And early brain development, that's also critically important. Single mother-headed families experiencing homelessness. We were delighted to read the beliefs associated with this congregation. They are very much all in sync with what we believe and are pretty much the reason why Catalyst Project exists.
And how?
It's also how we operate.
So what is Catalyst Project? We're ready for the next slide, yep. At its core, it is a partnership with the mothers. So together we try and co-create the physical, mental, and emotional space for them and their children to develop stability, voice, and reach their potential. So I think another way to kind of symbolically describe it is Catalyst as a sort of net. So we're holding it so that people can fall sometimes, as we all have in our lives. We just don't all have a net or a guardrail to catch us and let us get back up and try again. But we do all deserve that. So I think, too, in our daily lives, more and more, we're seeing evidence of the systems of inequity and injustice so clearly, perhaps more and more each day. And Catalyst is trying to simultaneously work to dismantle those systems of oppression while also evoking the voice of the members who have experienced the most hardship because of them. As the rabbit just taught us, we need to listen to their voices. We don't have the answers. We are certainly not fixing, even if it were nice to fix people for themselves. We don't know how to. We have to respond, and I think of it as sort of unleashing and co-navigating. And that mindset is why we relate so well to this quote from Lilla Watson. If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And we talk a lot about this with the moms too. This is a two-way street, a relationship. And I think that they are especially not used to that with white middle-class women who work with them in the sort of social services industry. That is not generally the approach because it's a little more complicated. It requires more nuance and complexity, and it's not just throwing money at a problem.
So another piece of how we operate is where to start. As an early childhood person, I know that you start with the youngest. There is the most vulnerability and the most opportunity at that malleable age in the brain development, as brain scans have clearly shown us. So this quote from James Heckman pretty much describes that angle we're coming from. Americans can most effectively address inequality in a society with a strategy of predistribution by enriching the parenting resources for young children in disadvantaged environments, not by redistribution of resources for adults. And I think to myself often about that when I'm hearing football stadiums are being built for economic, enrichment and development, and I think, oh my, you haven't read the research on early childhood, have you? But we also then have to address the ones who are most in need of our attention. And we have some pretty solid evidence on who that is. The 2017 report from the Wisconsin Center on, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, it's gotta be cows, right? reiterated Wisconsin's ranking among the worst states in the nation in terms of outcomes for African American children. So the response of the Race to Equity's 2016 roadmap proposed a two-generation strategy with three community goals. And it's interesting because when we read these after designing our program, we said, oh my gosh, that's what we're doing. The first one is, and I should have made a slide of this, but I guess you can look it up. They want to significantly increase the employment, income, and wealth of the low-income families of color and expand and improve supports for low-income families of color to better enable them to balance the twin challenges of parenting and success on the job. Thank you. You're good. And then the third one is, again, for the low-income families of color, but particularly for the children and youth, to ensure that a far greater of them get to kindergarten ready to learn, succeed in school, and succeed in adult life. And so we're like, oh, this is exactly what we're focusing on, the parenting and life, trying to balance that as a single mother and then of color in Dane County, and the children as being an integral part of that, so the two-pronged approach. Quick facts, we found it in March 2016, and I just want to say, to make that long story short, is I never wanted to do this. I wanted somebody else to do it. I did not want to do it myself. More on that later, maybe. Targeting single mothers with young children and those that were homeless or formerly homeless or underhoused or anyway in big trouble. And it was going to be a community home for between one and four families. Keyword, intensive intervention for both children and adults. And what is that?
So a snapshot of that, in daily life would be weekly meetings with each individual mom with us, some group meetings with Sagacious Levingston, as you heard the quote from before of Infamous Mothers, which she founded here in Madison. Those group meetings sometimes include discussion, yoga, scrapbooking, breath work, going to a movie, having a meal together, that kind of thing. And then whatever else the net of Catalyst might look like that week. So it might be transportation to a job or getting kids to childcare or school or doing emergency childcare, a grocery run, a phone call to process a situation, a playgroup or an event, coming to school meetings, etc. So there's a wide range of what that looks like on a day-to-day basis.
So the program is organized around four central focuses, but the key word here is simultaneous. These are not prioritized in order of importance or first things first, but very much, even when we're moving a family into our home, we are paying attention to supporting the connection between mother and child. We know every moment that a child is in, is anywhere, is a learning moment, so we're paying attention to what the child is learning. And certainly gauging the mental well-being of every single person there as best you can with 13, and observing and reflecting, trying to see where we can be useful.
So
looking at them, yeah, one at a time.
Or individually. So responsive mother-child relationship. What does responsive look like? It looks like being in tune with your child, the kind of sinking of the relationship, being able to be in tune with your child instead of worrying about where you're going to sleep or how you're going to get food. And then also the ability to reflect for yourself, for your child, and make choices about your parenting and decide what you want your relationship with your child to look like, rather than feeling like, I've just got to take what I get. I've got to just do what I got to do. I don't get to make a choice here. I just take what's in front of me. And notably, I think, too, this does not necessarily look like what it looks like when your kids were growing up, or your kids were growing up. So what does it take? Well, I think a big part of it is an environment that's set up for kids to promote interaction, that has what they need, but then also breaks. Quality childcare has been one of the biggest challenges for Catalyst, to find quality affordable, I should say, but even just quality childcare in general. A space for when moms are at school or at work, or I think anybody who is a parent deserves childcare, whether or not you have something specifically that you're going to, but somewhere that will add to the kids' lives rather than just keep them alive. So what part can we play?
Well, again, back to the rabbit. We wonder. We don't know. We have to pay attention, and we have to maybe wonder with the mother, or maybe just take cues from the environment, maybe offer, but never dictate. So again, it's that more complex system that isn't all laid out for you. You do this, this, and this. We're constantly fluid and flexible. Be flexible or die is my motto. I cannot tell you what happens sometimes, and the unpredictable nature of the whole situation. But we look for signs and we try things. That's what we do.
So stability, I mean, this is pretty clear stuff. We can't expect anybody to think about anything else if these things are not in place, right? So there's this kind of, she had said one time, it's almost like fire prevention rather than putting out fires. Like, how many bodies do we have to pull out of the river until we take a moment to go upstream and find out what's throwing them in?
Mm-hmm. And can find that moment, have that moment. What can we do to help them have that moment?
Mental well-being is the next one.
Well, this is foundational to everything, too. If you're an early childhood person, you know that the social-emotional competence of that ability to feel safe emotionally and physically is primary to learning anything. And if you're on high alert all the time, you are not learning nearly at your capacity. And so we look at the state of mental well-being, again, looking for cues, observations, insight into where we can be useful in supporting that mental well-being for the children and the adults as well. Now, usually if a person is struggling with an issue, somebody will say, well, they ought to talk to somebody, right? You know, they ought to go to therapy. Well, that's a lovely idea, and there's some lovely therapists out there. But you do have to find them. But the other thing is that if your life is so stressful that you are used to being on high alert, and your life has kind of evolved into a sort of chaotic mindset, it's to go through all those pieces to get to a therapy appointment once. So you have to call, and then you probably have to call back, and then you have to get the call back that the office gives you, and then you have to finally connect and make the appointment. Then you have to find out what to do with your children and get there. You may not have a car, and then you have to hope there's no crises on your way out the door with your children, and then you have to do it again, and then you have to do it again, and you may even have to switch therapists because this one's speaking with you. And I asked my friend who was a family advocate for Early Head Start, how many percent of moms that you work with do you think could really use some therapy? And she said, oh, 80%. And I said, how many do you know that have completed a course of treatment? And she said, none. And so we said, what else can we do besides send people to therapy?
So we have this sort of what we call integrated therapeutic intervention. We build it into every interaction. We have individual meetings, play groups, transportation to the grocery store, that kind of thing. And we are constantly just together kind of gathering information. We're pausing. We're sitting with it. We're not resolving it or fixing it, but we're wondering about it. And we try and incorporate the use of power skills like effective self-expression and self-exploration and collaboration.
Nonviolent communication.
Mm-hmm. And I see our presence as maintaining, almost like holding up a mirror to reflect their wants, desires, and inner wisdom through all the ups and downs and the tides of what comes up for each of them. It's really hard to maintain that when you're in the middle of a crisis, that vision, I think. And then also just being able to make connections in the moment between what's coming up for them in the present with what may have been going on in their life in the past. Opening up to anger, suffering, grounding ourselves in it, getting clues from our body. Trauma really shuts down our bodily awareness. That's kind of how it works. Our body gets really overwhelmed with the constant heightened arousal, so much so that it kind of just has to ignore it and cut it off. But that becomes problematic later when we want to be able to recognize stuff as it's starting to come up in us, kind of arousal of like anger or whatever the emotion might be, and then be able to choose our response. What happens when our brain takes over is that we just usually go into a very old like survival technique, which may have worked very well to keep the person alive in the past, but it doesn't work so well in their day-to-day life now when they're trying to move forward. So we do a lot of that kind of practice too. And it's just this sort of idea of, I see your suffering and I will stand with you, like the rabbit.
Sagacious, at one of our meetings once, we had been trying to promote this idea of nonviolent communication, of actually listening to what the person is saying to you and perhaps presenting your site in a way that isn't at top volume and full of nasty remarks, you know, saying a little bit more directly what it is that's making you mad. And so we had this piece of paper that had the steps of nonviolent communication, and we showed it to Sagacious, who is black, and if you don't know her, she's from the south side of Chicago, as she will say. Evidently, that speaks for itself. I don't really know, but she's grown up in some tough environments, and she said to the women, okay, well, I'm looking at this paper, she says, and she said, I'm thinking, this looks white. We're like, we did something wrong. And she said, blah, blah, and more remarks about it. And she said, but you know, that way of the past, the communication of the past, or somehow she referred to it, was about surviving. And this is about living. And that's
thriving, I think she could have said. Children's learning.
So fourth on the list, but certainly not last from an early childhood person is the aspect of bringing, stepping in and seeing what support we can provide, what usefulness we can be to take this very vulnerable age, an age of extreme opportunity and extreme vulnerability, to make that the enriched, nurturing, learning environment that the child needs to meet their potential. And so it has a lot to do with putting things in the environment and working with the mom and seeing what we can also bring in and finding that quality childcare. But it also proceeds on to affect the school achievement and the adult capacity, of course. So, for example, one thing we do is we offer a rent credit for every month that the child is in school.
Every day.
When they're not sick or not excused. So school sometimes seems to be a sort of a optional arrangement where you can get rid of the kids for a day. It may have been the mindset for a while, and we're trying to, but not expect people to adopt our mindset, using maybe something else to get in that rhythm and see the benefits. We have people going to conferences even sometimes.
So we have a little video, but I think maybe it's just 2 minutes in the next slide of what it like looks like. But I don't know if the speakers are on anymore. We can come back to
We can look it up.
Okay.
If he has to fool around, you could read this.
But, yeah. While he's doing that, I'll just read the quote on the next slide. It's by Annie Lamott in her book, Bird by Bird. And the quote is, "You couldn't have had any way of knowing what this piece of work would look like when you first started. You just knew that there was something about these people that compelled you, and you stayed with that something long enough for it to show you what it was about." Catalyst is by nature unconventional. And this quote, I think, really summed up. Sometimes I feel like we're not supposed to admit this, but I feel like I don't know what I'm doing or why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it is comforting to see this and to trust in the process of creating and co-creating Catalyst. It's what we're really doing. Someone asked us once on an interview, what have the families learned? And I can't even actually remember what I said. And it's not that I don't think the families learn anything, but what was most significant to me thinking about this later was that that's only half the story.
It's too bright to see the screen.
Okay. Yeah, I think that the better question is for me, what have I learned? And speaking especially a person who exists in this world as a privileged, able-bodied, cisgender, white,
middle-class woman. I am the one who can be learning how to be in a much less harmful, reckless way than many of us have been in this world. So what are we discovering together? This is a partnership, and we're kind of constantly asking ourselves those questions. Oops.
Okay.
It should.
Screen doing this.
Oh, did you, you clicked on it, but nothing happened?
No, I have to, I have to make the screen the same here.
Oh. Screen the same. Well.
I have one more thing.
Well, it looks like he's got potential.
I'll just read the last kind of poem that we were going to close with, and then we can watch this. It is from the elders of the Hopi Nation in Oraibi, Arizona. There is a river flowing now very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being torn apart, and they will suffer greatly. Know the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore and push off into the river. Keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. See who is in there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment that we do, our spiritual growth and our journey comes to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we have been waiting for. I think one thing I can think of initially when you say it doesn't look like, asking about the comment, it doesn't maybe look like what it does when your kids were growing up. Maybe I should add in there. I think when I was doing a lot of studying of child development and stuff, a lot of the research is based on white middle-class families. And so you can't necessarily extrapolate from that, that those are all the best things for every child of every different culture and with a different background. So for example, the moms I work with speak a lot more harshly and directly to their kids. And I think initially it can be like, oh, why do you have to talk to them like that? You know, they're be respectful. But the kids respond to that far better than a different approach, or at least with their mom, you know, that's what they expect. And the key that they found in research is not so much about if you ever speak harshly to your kid, but it is there warmth in the relationship as well? Is that what the kid can expect? And I think a lot of times we find that being too, you know, well, what do you think? Well, how about we do this together? You know, kids can feel uncomfortable with kind of a lack of understanding where the boundary is and what they have control over and what they don't. These kids have to sit in for hours in an office waiting for an appointment. And they have to not create such a big scene that they get kicked out of the building. So, I mean, it's just by nature part of their lives.
For example, if their mom has a doctor appointment for one of the kids, and everybody has to come if you're a single mom, right, and you don't have childcare. So that's the type of thing. Sagacious said to us once, talking about how children of color get in trouble in the school system, don't ask him if he wants to do something, if it's not a choice, you know. And so we're very careful to be, you know, very tactful and respectful, but.
I'll just answer the second question really quick.
Fuzzy.
Self-expression too. I think that's where the breath work and the looking like yoga, or I mean, sometimes we even just do the Shavasana piece where you lay down. Kind of scanning our body before a group meeting. Like, is there anything you notice in your body? Like a tenseness anywhere? And starting to just pay attention to those things. But also talking about anger as giving us information rather than something bad that they need to squelch. and sadness and all of those things. And using things like what we color a lot of times in our meetings too. We do scrapbooking, art kind of activities like that, and writing, encouraging that.
So sort of disseminating the anger, but Anna also directly spoke to the anger when one mom got a phone call from school that her daughter was disrespectful while we were at her house, and she was telling us all this and that that she was going to do. And Anna said, well, what would you like to her to understand from whatever it is you say you're wanting to do to her? Well, that was a much more a message we could work with then. Well, I want her to know that she's not going to be like I was and get into trouble like I did. And so then we were able to take that into a letter to the child that was delivered when she got home from school, and it was a much different communication than what the mother had said she wanted to do.
So we have had three families live with us over the past 3 years. One is still with us, and two of them have just recently moved to new apartments. So we don't put, it's almost like, we didn't do a slide on this, but there are, we're discovering that the best way to kind of arrange it is phases. Instead of having a time period, which I used to work in a transitional living program, and I found that a lot of the kids who left went right back into homelessness because it was an arbitrary time set. It wasn't based on readiness or like other things like that developing. So we try and create a model where there's phases. Okay, you're in phase one. Ideally, we'd like to have them not have to pay rent in phase one, because a lot of them are trying to get out from a lot of debt that may or may not have been anything to do with their own personal actions. And so we don't want to pile on to that. But at one point I think we had 13 people, like moms and kids, living in the house, and that's when we were like, we don't need a fourth family. This is enough people to coordinate. But there's two separate units. So one has two bedrooms and a bathroom, and then the other side has two bedrooms, a bathroom, kitchen on the first floor, and the basement has a bedroom and a bathroom and like a little ensuite area for like a young child to have sort of their own bedroom. And the other spaces are communal, so like the play spaces and the kitchen and the laundry, and they're shared, and that gives us many opportunities to work on relationships and getting along and triggers, understanding our own triggers and triggers that other people might have.
Ways to interpret behaviors.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
What made you think that this is why that happened? Was there anything particular? And then sorting through all that and realizing, oh, well, maybe there is more information that could affect my assumption. The immediate assumption is usually that somebody is disrespecting you or.
And it's a long-term but not permanent housing program is kind of how we describe it. And this is sort of why I think one of the unconventional pieces of Catalyst is that we've only had three families then in the past 3 years. And a lot of programs have like, you know, we serve 150 and we do this and that and specifically, and we're trying to provide a much more intensive wraparound long-term effect. And I wanted to answer quick about funding. We're like, what is it, 60%?
That was the original budget was 60%. Don't stand in front
right,
of that.
Right, come over here. Yeah, there you go.
60% grants and donations and 30% program fees, but we quickly found out the program fees, which are sort of the rent, which was low for the area, but not low enough for somebody who's coming out of desperate poverty. And so quickly all the resources for the rent were gone, and then we were scrambling. So we are not funded, and it is something I think about when I read about the $11.5 million for 44 units downtown
and Tree Lane,
and then additional funding in there. I think they're doing the right thing. They definitely have too many people in there for the resources that have been allocated, but we also think a smaller unit just doesn't tend to end up looking like the Army as much in a welcoming neighborhood, and so there's other things, but I haven't written up my discussion about this to the city elders yet, but in my spare time I will.
And the rent that they pay was to cover the mortgage cost of the house. So yeah. My partner and my dad actually made the down payment on the house with the agreement that, okay, you make the down payment, we'll make the mortgage payments. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, the families could pay the rent, but quickly that, their lives did not allow for that kind of stable income, and we are working very hard not to evict families because of that. So we create alternative rent arrangements.
Anna and Susan, will you be around for a few minutes after the service? I imagine there are more questions people have we could get to, but thanks so much.
Okay.
Then, and I just want to also mention about Catalyst, that particular project is sort of in line with what Social Action's been trying to do in the last couple of years in terms of the charities we're focusing on. It's focused on homeless issues and people, and is clearly really local. I'm going to be reading the closing words for today. It's from the Bible. Train children in the way that they should go. When they grow old, they won't depart from it. It's in Proverbs. So, thanks everybody for coming. Time to stand and greet your neighbor and join us afterwards for coffee and cake with Sandy.